Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 4th of December 2007. Quite a striking day, in fact. It's Ian Purdy's birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you, John. I'm having a very, very... I'm having a wonderful time, actually.
You've been having a wonderful time for several days now.
Oh, man, I've been having a wonderful time for 50 years.
50 whole years. Actually, I've got an interesting show coming up. Well, first up, we'll have Dean Tong on. He's the author of several books, Elusive Innocence, Ashes to Ashes, and Don't Blame Me, Daddy, from the US. That should be a fascinating interview. He's an expert in false allegations. We'll also be playing a speech from John Waters. He's a social commentator and journalist from Ireland and a fascinating speaker. That should be a fascinating interview as well. We'd like to welcome everyone who's joining us from around the world via live streaming on the 2GLF website, and don't forget also that you can listen to this program by just clicking on the listen button at our website, www.dadsontheair.net. Of course, the big news in Australia is that we have a new government, and there's an old saying, if you change the government, you change the country, which is certainly very much the case. They were all sworn in yesterday, and it's very, very interesting. One of the most striking things, I suppose, is on the front pages today. We have an Asian-born Minister for Climate Change who is parading around with her partner, she's taken her lesbian partner with her to the conference, which is a very progressive, if you like to call it.
Very progressive, yes.
Times have changed.
Times have changed. I mean, certainly it would be almost impossible to imagine any such thing. Here's just a little bit from the swearing in.
But it was the Labor front benchers' babies who actually stole the show, with the Labor Senator Stephen Conroy's daughter Isabella, born through surrogacy after her mother Paula Benson battled ovarian cancer, shouting "Dada, Dada!" as he swore an oath of office. Isabella could be seen happily crawling on the richly carpeted floors of Canberra's Government House behind Mr Rudd as the ceremony continued. New Housing Minister Tanya Plibersek's son Joe called out, "Is it my turn now, Mum?" as she was called to be sworn in. Health Minister Nicola Roxon's two-year-old daughter Rebecca was also there, and Finance Minister Lindsay Tanner's daughter Ainsley watched on in a pink polka dot skirt. So there's plenty of kids there.
Plenty of kids there. I suppose that's a good sign. You know, Kevin Rudd, the new Prime Minister, has said that he will govern for all Australians, and we'll be interested to see whether or not that proves to be the case. One particular group has put out a countdown of the first 100 days in the Strengthening Families campaign. And we've got this from the Richard Hillman Foundation. I think the Shared Parenting Council are also behind this. And they've put out a press release saying what happens when children are denied equal shared parenting. And that is, of course, you know, having contact with mum and dad. And, you know, not everyone's in a position where they can stay married. And but the best alternative is to have both parents still involved in the children's life, if at all possible, which we've argued very strongly here. They point out that kids who don't see their dads have lower academic achievement. 38% of elementary students from single-parent homes achieving below what they would normally achieve. 30% of children from father-present homes are high achieving, while only 70% of children from father-absent homes are high achieving. They have lower math scores, a greater failure rate, lower IQ and achievement. Children lost fathers before age 5 scored lower on the various tests. At junior high and high school students, they're more likely to drop out of school and less likely to attend college. And they ask the question, the key question, in whose interest is it for the current situation to continue? And Mr Rudd has about 90 days left to demonstrate that he is a man of principle and a Prime Minister for all Australians. Let's hope. I mean, there's a lot of goodwill towards Kevin Rudd at this point, and he's the preferred Prime Minister by some smashing percentage, 60-something percentage. He's in there with a huge mandate let's hope that he uses it well and doesn't use it to bash up on people like separated dads, for example. One of the absolute conflicts of the past government was that it was supposedly a conservative government, but was also a massive spender. This is also, as was the previous piece from the Australian newspaper, and there's a piece by Peter Saunders, who's been a regular guest on this program, just talking about what he thinks the new government should do.
Yes, he writes, taxation by stealth must top reform list. Throughout the federal election campaign, Kevin Rudd boasted of being an economic conservative. Now he has the chance to prove it. His first priority should be reform of personal income tax. Bracket creep increases the government's tax take every year and allows politicians to hand the money back at election time, masquerading as genuine tax cuts. This is dishonest. It is taxation by stealth. To establish fiscal probity, Rudd should index all tax thresholds to inflation. Unemployment is at a 30-year low, but there are approaching 750,000 disability claimants and 600,000 on the parenting payment. Many of these people are unemployed by another name. They could and should be working. For some people, it is, but the real... The
goes
real
solution. On.
He does go on. You know, it's a great article.
He does go on to talk about the family tax payments A and B in the article and how incredibly confusing this is. Millions of Australians under the previous Howard government basically became clients of Centrelink and, it just middle class welfare.
And of course, they redefined what unemployed was. I mean, people who. They just changed all of the categories, and a lot of people who were actually unemployed were classed as employed due to, redefining what the word was supposed to have meant.
Four hours a week work was employed.
Yeah, it was full employment. I mean, I think the figures are very misleading.
Anyway, we'll be back in a moment, and we'll be talking with Dean Tong.
Thank you.
And we're talking with Dean Tong. He's an author from the US and the author of several books, including Elusive Innocence, Ashes to Ashes, Families to Dust, and Don't Blame Me, Daddy. Welcome to Dad's on the Air.
John, thanks for having me. It's an honor.
No, that's great. Thank you very much. Now, I suppose we ask most of our people, how did it all begin? How did you get interested in this particular area of false allegations?
Well, like most, John, I was hit firsthand. So my story began 22 years ago in a little town in North Florida, and I was in the midst of a very bitter divorce and custody battle. And at the time, we didn't have many studies on children's suggestibility, on taint hearings. The law hadn't even yet caught up. So I basically tell everybody that my case, because it was such an extreme miscarriage of justice, was the end product of delayed law and delayed science. But in the midst of that bitter divorce and custody battle, I found myself accused of sexually molesting my then 3-year-old daughter twice. And on the second allegation, I was arrested, charged with capital sexual battery, which in Florida was at the time punishable by 25 years to life imprisonment on a conviction. And I guess the state figured where there's smoke, there's fire. I'm guilty by association because I was accused twice within a 5-month time frame in 1985. The short of the long was 10 years of litigation in 6 different courts using 7 attorneys, going through 7 psychologists, spending $150,000, which, of course, at that time was a lot of money. And even though the state dropped the criminal charges, I was never again allowed to see my kids unsupervised overnight. The best I got was 8 hours on a Sunday, and that didn't happen until 1990.
Unbelievable. The kids are growing up now, I suppose.
Yeah. They're 26 and almost 25. I am sad to say that their mother, my accuser behind the engineering of these allegations, died 3 years ago of terminal cancer. And as heinous as these allegations are, you never want to see that happen. But we've made a lot of gains. I went on, of course, to publish books, to do a lot of media, change laws here in Florida. I actually ran for politics here in Florida in 1994. I'm thinking about doing so again.
Really? So it's getting a fair bit of play in the U.S., is it, this whole... It's an absolute phenomenon, isn't it, in family courts?
I think it's starting to catch up in your country, John. I don't have too many phone calls. Of course, Lionel...
Richards.
Richards and I were very close. So he would call me once every 2 or 3 months, and just a travesty when he passed. But, you know, New South Wales and Sydney, Melbourne... I actually have one client who's an Aussie who lives in Arizona, and he was accused 5 times of molesting his little girl, and that included urophilia, which basically means he was accused of peeing on her 150 times. just some crazy, crazy stuff. I mean, there's basically nothing I haven't seen, because now, I'm a professional consultant, and I've been hired now in these cases in the states, in 46 of the 50 states, wow, as well as Canada. And I've had Brits and Aussie clients here in the States. I have not yet been retained in a case from your country or the UK.
There is a thing that people, the other side of the fence, I guess, say that such allegations are actually fairly rare, that it's fairly rare to make a false allegation, that a woman just wouldn't do this sort of thing and wouldn't make up such terrible accusation.
I think that comes down, John, to the definition of what false is. By definition, at least here in the States, false means with malice aforethought, with premeditation and bad faith. So I think on that end, because it's so hard to prove...
Yeah, impossible, isn't it, really?
Well, it's not impossible, but you know, unless you were running a tape recorder, in some states it's legal to do that, or you had a private investigator, you know, wiretapping or whatever. But the point is... It's about as hard to prove as RICO, racketeering, influence, and corrupt organizations. So most of these allegations are unfounded, about two-thirds, 60 to 67, 68%.
Really?
About 2 to 5% are considered false. But make no mistake, most of these allegations are unfounded, meaning in psychology we call this source misattribution errors. In other words, either the child was molested, but you got the wrong guy, mistaken identity, and we'll get into this during the show when I talk about testing I put through clients. The other more common scenario is it just didn't happen, and there's another alternative hypothesis for what's gone on here.
And it's just, I've seen a lot of documentation of people who've been falsely accused of sexually molesting their children, and it's amazing the way the trail builds up. You only need one psychiatrist in the string to say, yes, they've been abused, and they get backed up by every subsequent finding. Is that?
Yeah, CPS, guardian ad litem, the lawyer for the child, therapist, counselor, medical doctor, nurse, doing the rape exam. Of course, the lady who usually does the forensic interview here in the States, we usually do them now on DVD or video. But yeah, I mean, you know, and make no mistake, these allegations are part and parcel to parental alienation. Mm-hmm. And when the children start participating in this vilification denigration campaign, talking bad, usually against daddy because he's the one wrongly accused, you know, we refer to that as parental alienation syndrome. Although, of course, it's never been published in a scientific manual like the DSM-4. Mm. Parental alienation happens in about 90% of my cases. So for anybody who wants to contest me in the national or international media that parental alienation doesn't happen, bring them on. it's the scourge. It's the scourge of child custody.
Dean, it's Peter Vandervoort here. What seems to be overlooked by the family law industry is the extent to which young people, young children especially, have absolutely no autonomy and are very vulnerable to physical and psychological manipulation and control by the.
If you look at it, Peter. When you think about it, I don't know what the age of children's wishes are in Australia, where a kid can tell a judge in camera, I want to live with my daddy or my mommy, but here in the States, it's usually 11, 12, or some states, it's even 14. But if they can say that, you know, daddy touched me in bad or secret places at age 3, then why are we waiting till age 11 or 12 for a child to deduce what parent he or she wants to live with?
Exactly.
They're obviously giving the kid credibility at age 3 or 2.5, which is barely verbal, but they wait another 10 years until a child is basically is post-pubescent to basically state to a judge, you know, with credibility, who I want to live with. So maybe if we're going to continue running these false allegation cases, domestic violence and sex abuse, out in a factory-type epidemic, maybe we should think about lowering the age of children's wishes down to 6 or 7, at least 7, the age of reason, where a child knows right from wrong, truth from falsehood, and good touches from bad touches.
Is there a percentage of actual custody disputes where these sorts of accusations are made?
There have been a few studies, John and Peter, and nothing really, you know, that I can quote to sink my teeth in. But experts here in the States, like Douglas Bezhurov, basically state that it's around... you know, it's around 30 to 35%, about one third
of all custody disputes.
I like to double that to around the two thirds, 66-67%.
It's just an absolutely normal part of the arsenal, isn't it?
When Dr. Gardner was alive, and of course he died, you know, 3 or 4 years ago here in New Jersey, the author of the Predation Syndrome. He said the most critical construct or issue on the table with the false allegations is timing. The timing consistent to when the dynamics of the divorce, custody battle, visitation dispute surfaced. Very, very, very important. And if you read my chapter in my book, Elusive Innocence, the SED Syndrome, Sexual Allegations and Divorce, if you read the original article, which is online, by the way, at Google, the SED syndrome by Drs. Gordon Blush and Carol Ross from 20 years ago, you'll see the timing of the allegation is very critical. You have to examine the credibility, reliability, validity of the allegations in a totally different light when you have a divorce, visitation dispute, and custody battle on the table.
For the alienating parent, it's the easiest way to eliminate the father or the non-custodial parent out of the lives of their children, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Because it only needs to be an allegation.
You know, it was called, when I was going through this gentleman 22 years ago, which of course was the same time that Ray Bucky and Peggy Peggy, I can't remember her last name, McMartin, I guess, the McMartin daycare case in California, where everybody got convicted and eventually all the convictions were overturned. You know, again, we didn't have the law, we didn't have the science, but juries were running rampant with convictions. So back then it was called legal napalm, divorce's atomic bomb, the ultimate weapon. And it still is. I mean, you know, I do this for a living. I do occasional cases pro bono. I do many cases at reduced fees because obviously attorneys, barristers, solicitors are very expensive. Experts are very expensive. And fees can run up to astronomical numbers very quickly.
Very quickly. There's a thing in the law here where a judge only has to have a lingering doubt that it may have occurred for the father to be denied contact with the children. Is it similar in the U.S.?
It's not called lingering doubt, but it's called a preponderance of evidence. So basically 51%. It's 51 to 49, prima facie evidence. And if the judge believes 51% that you're more guilty than not, knowing that the standard of law here in the States is the children's best interest, then oftentimes judges will err and make mistakes on the side of the kid, not father, and therefore father loses, as I call him in my book, a fatherectomy. So it's very sad, and I get back to the lack of education, the lack of training, not just by the system professionals, the social workers, the police officers, the prosecutors, the judges on the bench, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the therapists, the counselors, but also the lawyers representing fathers. They don't get specialized training in this. They don't get courses in law on how to try false allegation cases. My book is not a bestseller in your country, in the UK, in Canada, or even here in the U.S. for that matter. You know, I do get a lot of queries, obviously, by email and phone. Sometimes they can be overwhelming, but we need to educate and train the entire system. And I hope that the system, as its pendulum is swinging, legislatively speaking, will actually want to have on board fathers that have been wrongly accused, maybe who have went on to be activists like Lionel, like you guys having this this radio talk show. And chat listservs,
because
to want your input. Because not only are children victims of abuse, not only are women and mothers victimized in domestic assault situations, I would say for every valid, reliable allegation, there are 2 to 4 that are unreliable and invalid.
And those people often pay for that for the rest of their lives, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, and it affects everybody, not just the immediate accused, obviously, but the entire family dynamics, brothers and sisters and siblings and parents and grandparents and everybody involved. It's just a nightmare. And the error rate, you know, if you had asked me 22 years ago, would I be doing this for a living for the last 15 years, I would say you're nuts.
Yeah,
I should never have been able to make my living by consulting on false allegation cases. That in and of itself should speak volumes on how messed up the system is.
Because the system absolutely encourages it, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, the laws encourage it. Absolutely. There is a money motivation factor. Kids go into foster care. There's money being made there by foster families. Obviously, criminal cases are won based on statements of fear, of threatened bodily harm with no proof, no evidence, domestic violence. Statements by children, outcries. Daddy touched me in a bad or secret spot after scripting, after repetitive grilling and interviewing by mother and grandmother and social worker and police officer and doctor and nurse and counselor. Obviously, the child will eventually become a microcassette recorder. So the entire system is predicated on victories. They don't care about your emotional, psychological, financial, spiritual welfare. They could care less.
Couldn't
care
less.
All they care about is a victory in court, so that they can falsely inflame their statistics and get more dollars to keep the wheels spinning.
Oh, what an appalling system. We're talking with Dean Tong. He's the author of a number of books on false allegations. We'll be back after this quick break. Talking with Dean Tong. Are you there, Dean?
I'm here, John.
Good. All right. Look, thanks very much. Now, you've got a couple of new books coming out. Can you just talk a bit about what that's all about?
I do have Children of the Lie, L-I-E, is going to make its way to the bookstores and libraries, hopefully, internationally, I hope. And certainly I'd like to donate several copies to your organization. And
Thank you.
You know, it, again, for me, it's not a money-making scheme. But anyway, that book is coming out, and I hope it to be the Bible of helping lawyers, barristers, solicitors in court with their clients, kind of a playbook, if you will, a cookbook, blow by blow. It'll include stories of those falsely accused. It'll include the agencies, the profiles of the accuser, the child victim. And when I say child victim, I mean a false allegation, the non-abused child treated as a truly abused victim. And we see the same signs and symptoms, I might add. And I do have some data on that.
Yeah.
Profiles of the accuser. We find a lot of cases where the psychological profiles are erroneously conducted on delusional accusers, perhaps mistaken diagnoses, histrionic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, delusional paranoid personality disorder. So, you know, basically my job is reviewing the reviewers, critiquing the critiquers, evaluating the evaluators. And that includes micromanaging the case of the attorney. I have to make sure the pleadings are legally sufficient, the proper motions and case law was cited, memorandum of law. And, of course, if I am asked to participate in a trial, making sure that counsel objected appropriately and on the right grounds, you know, where he or she errors of commission, errors of omission, what lawyers and experts have done wrong and what they've missed.
And there are still
I see this in a plethora of my cases.
Right, and there are still thousands of parents every year having the children removed from them purely as a result of these types of accusations.
Yeah, it's a combination of system dynamics, mindset, kids don't lie about sexual abuse, women don't lie about domestic abuse, and of course the legal threshold is so slim here in the United States anyway, under the Violence Against Women's Act, Any allegation of hitting, pushing, biting, throwing, shoving, without any proof or evidence is enough to put you in handcuffs or at least separate you from your child.
We've just had the Minister for Environment in this state, literally today it's all in the newspapers, has had to stand down because of allegations made 20 years ago by his former wife, which he's rigorously denied. But and there's no police involvement, no evidence.
That case may require a cognitive memory expert. I just got done with a trial in Texas on that similar type of case.
Dean, you had very limited contact with your children. Now that they're grown up, have you been able to establish a relationship with them or continue a relationship with them at all?
You know, I have John and Peter, but it's strained. It's not what it should be. You have to understand that my ex-wife, who of course, as I alluded to earlier, passed away 3 years ago, was deemed unfit by the same court who made her allegations against me valid to separate me from my kids. So very oxymoronic, very hypocritical court orders that made no sense whatsoever. And the fact that I was basically extricated from their lives, the alienation set in. And it's not like they've gone to 10 years of counseling for deprogramming. That's very hard to do. We do have an agency called the Rachel Foundation here in Texas that gets involved legally and tries to institute therapy to abate the alienation of the child when it's gone, as Gardner said, from slight to moderate to severe. He had three phases of it. So it's certainly not what I'd like it to be. Yes, we talk. Yes, we celebrate holidays together, but we see each other maybe half a dozen times a year.
And this is really common, isn't it? I've known from other men that I've known that this has happened to, that often the kids don't actually come back, do they?
I think, gentlemen, in my particular case, because I've been so vocal, I've been so active throughout the years, I've been on basically every major television show in America. I think the kids took it offense. I think they took it as a slap in their face because their last name was always in the media. And of course, my last name sounds Chinese, but I'm not Oriental. So you don't see many white Caucasian Tongs.
No, I was wondering about that.
I usually get that first thing in the TV shows, but. So the kids, you know, they didn't like it when I took this issue to the media, took it to the lawmakers, tried to change the laws. Here in Florida now, malicious false allegations are a third-degree felony. That's been on the books now for almost 10 years, in part thanks to yours truly. So now if you make a malicious false allegation in Florida, you can go to prison for 5 years. Of course, again, the rub is trying to prove that.
So did the children ever realize that you were actually doing that to give them their rights?
I think now they are. They're just starting to get over their mother passing away 3 years ago. They lost their mother at a fairly, you know, tender ages, 21 and 22. And they're now starting to read my books. They're starting to archive the articles that were published on me 15, 20 years ago. Not just on my case, but on my work, where I took this, to the general pervasive issue of trying to fix the false allegations. Because I've always said, if you win the battle against false allegations, you'll win the war against abuse.
Yes.
And because it must be forgivable for some of these judges, I suppose, faced with these warring parents who you have no idea where the truth of the matter lies, so they err on the side of caution, or that's the way they see it.
You know. I think John and Peter, until we augment and increase the judicial legal threshold of evidence from this, I think you call it lingering doubt in your country, preponderance of evidence in my country, to what we call clear and convincing evidence, which is 75%. Then the judges are going to have to have real meat, real substantive evidence and facts and data and science, not just hearsay. I mean, so much hearsay is admissible in these cases, it's sickening.
Oh, totally. Oh, there's not much else to go on because it's such a farcical jurisdiction in so many ways.
So many children and parents affected. Are you aware of any deprogramming programs that are available, that are working?
Like I said, you can go to rachelfoundation.org. That's one that's been in the works now for about 10 years here in America.
Successful.
There's another one called breakthroughparenting.com. That's Dr. Jane Major. She's a PhD in California and an expert in parental alienation. Certainly we have Dr. Glenn Cartwright in Canada. Is very good.
They've got the programming.
Yeah, they have some programs, but it's tough because you know the lawyer has to file a motion for the court to appoint the expert, and oftentimes mother's attorney will raise holy heck trying to contest that.
So, Dean, what motivates? I suppose it's primarily women that make these accusations. What motivates them to do this?
I think it's several things. I think using motive, method, and opportunity. The child as a pawn, weapon, and tool as ammunition motivates mother to secure child custody, secure child support, secure alimony, social status as the most fit parent in the community,
yes.
And daddy is perceived as a monster.
Yes.
And
there is a lot of social status from that.
I think with that, you've got plenty of motivation. It's not just a monetary motivation, but it's a social stigma. And, here in this country, these allegations are so reprehensible, so heinous when they happen. And, of course, we do have, genuine cases like Polly Kloss, who was, raped and killed by Richard Davis, and Megan Kanka, which became Megan's Law. Jesse Tamendaquez was her rapist and killer. Megan's Law, of course, is when you are convicted or plea bargain, you have to register as a sex offender for the rest of your life, basically. Plus, they post your mug on the state police website. So, these cases make front page headlines, and then the false allegation reversals, whether it's Barry Scheck, the Innocence Project on DNA, or a case that I consult on, gets a little paragraph on the back page. And again, America is, and pretty much the world is just so appalled. It's so unconscionable. Sex with a child, that prescription just doesn't mix. And juries and judges are just so their mindset, it's so vulgar in their mindset, they have to rule against the accused, even though it's just an allegation.
And no flicker of conscience from any of these judges as to what they're sentencing these men to. That typical image of the bloke wandering around with endless files trying to prove his innocence is so sad.
That's part of my formula, because you are guilty until proven innocent. And I send most of my clients who are under police criminal investigation for polygraphs. I send them for psychosexual testing, including the ABLE screen, for those of you in Australia, New South Wales, who aren't privy to the ABLE screen. The website is ABELScreen.com. It's a very reliable and valid procedure. It's not just a subjective paper-pencil test where you can hoodwink or feign or skew the results. It's basically somewhat involuntary. In other words, brain penis. Meaning, if you have sexual arousal or interest in children, you will act on that stimulus and vice versa. About 96% of my clients who I've submitted through this testing, and there's many more tests besides the ABLE screen, but that's just one, come out, pass with flying colors and get a clean bill of psychosexual health. And for those who want to click on the study that I had published in the American Journal of Family Therapy last year, just go to my website, abuse-excuse.com, and right above my picture on the left side of the homepage where I was on Dr. Phil a few years ago, you'll see the study. The study was titled The MSI-2, The Penile Plethysm Graph, and the ABLE Assessment for Sexual Interest. And it's an excellent study. We achieved clinical significance, and mine was not the first one ever conducted, but it did reinforce that these tests for alleged pedophilia are valid, are reliable, assuming you have the right psychologist or psychiatrist administering the tests and the correct scores and interpretation of the data is correct. And, of course, we look for sexual interest or arousal. We look for antisocial personality, we look for poor impulse control, and we look for what's called cognitive distortions, meaning you're in justifiable denial or you're not. In other words, you're a con man trying to pull the wool over us, or you're not. And that's a very important construct that we look for in these tests. Those are the four things we look for in these battery of psychosexual tests, which I think are just very, very important, especially in these he said, she said, what a child said cases.
And that sort of evidence is accepted, is it? Quite readily by the court?
In most states it is now. In Canada, in America, we have what's called Daubert-Frye hearings. In Canada, it's called the Mohan, M-O-H-A-N, Mohan hearing for expert evidence for theories, expert scientific theories that are in controversy. And you may have to have this hearing, this challenge, if you will, where a judge becomes the gatekeeper of the science, and of course it has to be peer-reviewed, it has to be published, it has to have a known error rate, it has to be reliable and valid, it has to be replicated, inter-rater reliability, very important. And if you can show all that, usually it comes in. I haven't had any trouble, but again, not all attorneys are created equal, not all experts are created equal, and I have found that out the hard way over the last 20 years.
We're talking with Dean Tong. He's the author of a number of books. He's the world's leading expert on false sexual abuse allegations in custody disputes. He's written a number of books, including Elusive Innocence, Ashes to Ashes, and Don't Blame Me, Daddy. We'll be back in a moment.
Rosie Gaines. We're back with
Dads on the Air. And we're talking with Dean Tong. We're talking with Dean Tong. He's the author of a number of books and one of the world's leading experts, or the world's leading expert on false sexual abuse allegations. Dean, what is the impact on the children of who've had lived in a family where this has happened?
I've seen non-abused kids who are treated as truly molested victims, John, suffer regressive behaviors, basically flashbacks, nightmares, chills, fevers, curling up in a fetal position, post-traumatic stress disorder. The emotional, psychological fallout is incredible. And even sometimes you see physical manifestations. They can't eat. They can't sleep. Grades start going down in school. Very traumatic. And unfortunately, most of the system professionals haven't read the Hickman and Reynolds article that I have from 1994, which details what I'm talking about. Psychologist from Texas who actually did a study in association with the Travis County Bar Association that actually showed the impact. Two kids that haven't been molested, but they were treated de novo, meaning beforehand, with therapies, dolls, puppets, drawings. As kids get older, what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, abuse-focused and trauma-focused, CBT, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, EMDR, all these pseudoscientific therapies, which are not reliable, they are totally invalid, yet we see this all the time being administered to kids as alleged victims before a criminal conviction has happened, before a judge has made a finding of fact and conclusion of law. That the child has been molested by the defendant or by the, by the respondent father.
Oh, really? I didn't realize that. So, essentially, it just has an absolutely appalling impact on them. There's no education out there to people thinking of making these sorts of allegations. There's nothing to counter it, is there?
Other than myself and a few other consultants and some legal teams, throughout the globe, I'm sure there are a few in your country that specialize in these types of cases. How much of the psychology and science knowledge and background they have that I bring to the table in a case remains to be seen. I had a case where my guy was getting ready to plea bargain in Arizona a few years ago, and the family raised the funds to retain myself and the lawyer I wanted to work with. And to make a long story short, the state did drop charges, and the most egregious mistake made by the professionals in that case was the 4-year-old child's hymen was said to be broken, absent. Well, it just so happens I sent the colposcopic photographs and the medical report to my own pediatrician from California, and she said that, Dean, the reason the hymen is absent and you can't see it is because it's masked, covered up by labial adhesions. So the nurse is 100% inaccurate and erroneous and wrong and mistaken.
And it could have sent a father to jail.
When I got involved, gentlemen, he had already spent 6 months in jail. It took another 8 months.
Shocking.
14 months for him to finally walk out of jail a free man. I actually went to see him in jail during the interim time I was under retainer. And now I might add that we have filed a huge lawsuit against the state of Arizona and their fiduciaries for the egregious, outrageous treatment of this man and his daughter.
And he wouldn't be the only one.
No. There are literally scores of cases that I could talk about, both nationally and then clients from the past, my own clients. I probably consult on 1,000 a year. And I'm retained in probably 50 out of that 1,000. So I literally some days will go days without getting an email or a call, and the next day I get 10 or 12.
So what do you advise to someone who this happens to, who has a false sexual abuse allegation made against them?
Men and fathers, John and Peter, are.
It's really common.
I like to call it. They suffer from what I call wimp syndrome.
Yeah.
And they're very, for the most part, when it comes to the law and science and experts, they're very naive and unwitting. So they will be the first to get down to the police station and submit to a polygraph or what's called a CVSA, computer voice stress analysis test. They'll be the first to talk to the police or to a prosecutor without legal counsel present. I get clients to do that all the time. So The first thing you do is you never talk to Child Protective Services or the police without legal counsel present. You then create a timeline, which is a journalistic history by dates and events, basically memorializing on paper, or better yet, in your microprocessor, in your computer, you know, the events as you recall them, leading up to perhaps the divorce, the custody, you know, the custody case, the visitation dispute, whatever led to those circumstances. You know, lawyers always require these timelines. There's a website, x10.com, x10.com, where for $250 you can actually stock your house with these audio and video mini cams. Great accountability, because oftentimes kids who are victimized, who are programmed, who are brainwashed, who are coached to make false allegations against their father, will say things off the cuff, contemporaneously, spontaneously, at dad's house on a visit, even in front of a supervisor, if he has supervised visitation. And, you know, if you have the kid's audio on tape, of course, you just tell the court, you know, if that tape was going to be deemed inadmissible because, you know, for legal purposes, it just can't be done. You just tell the judge, you know, I didn't do it for that purpose, Your Honor. I did it to stop burglaries in my house. It's a security mini cam for my house. It protects my house against vandals. So, at any rate, that's a good thing to do. Certainly, you have to retain the right lawyer. There is a appendix in Elusive Innocence. There'll also be one in Children of the Lie, entitled How to Choose Your Attorney. Very important, because I mean, the advocate for your case, the guy who's going to be drafting the pleadings, filing the same in court, arguing your case in court, is going to be your barrister, your solicitor. So you have to choose the right lawyer. And just realize that most lawyers don't do this type of case, the false allegation of sex abuse or domestic violence case, for a living. They also do the bankruptcy, the DUI. You have to see their resume. You have to see, you don't have to, they're not going to give you their client list, but you know, you have to know what kind of a lawyer are you plunking dollars down on.
All right, David, look, we're running out of time. I know you're publishing your autobiography next year. Could you just mention that, and we'll have to get out of here?
Yeah, that's called Father's Day, and I hope to have it out on Father's Day, actually not next year, but 2009. It's called Father's Day, a memoir of nightmare, daylight, and redemption, basically my 25-year odyssey through this incredible, meandering labyrinth of a system which charges itself to protect kids. And I might add that this is a child protection system first, a family reunification system second. So once your constituents understand that, when they can't understand they're being arrested, carted off to jail, or they're losing a child protection hearing, again, all the reinforcements are on the side of protecting the kid, not reuniting the kid with daddy. So it does require a very aggressive, a very proactive Mike Tyson type of legal defense team.
All of which costs an absolute fortune.
Well, you know, I mean, like I said, I try to cut my fees where I can. Obviously, around the holidays, I always do so. And, you know, if you want to say I'm playing Santa Claus, you know, whatever. I charged a man today who hired me from Idaho, who just got arrested for domestic violence, fees I was charging back in 2000. So, you know, hopefully your constituents can find attorneys, barristers, solicitors who have a passion for this work, who really consider the victory, the helping the father who helps the kids, more so than padding his pocketbook.
Look, we're out of time, Dean. Look, thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. It's fantastic to be able to talk to you.
That was my pleasure. I hope the interview serves some purpose and helps some gentlemen out there.
Thanks, Dean, and all the best for Christmas, too.
Thanks, you too. Have a happy New Year also.
Thank you. We've been talking with Dean Tong. As we said, he's the author of a number of books, Elusive Innocence, Ashes to Ashes, Family to Dust, and Don't Blame Me, Daddy. And there's also a website that he has. Just Google Dean Tong, basically, T-O-N-G, and you'll find a mass of material by him. He's the world's leading expert on false sexual abuse allegations and done some amazing work on the impacts on so many people. We'll be back.
We're going to listen to a speech at the Amen Conference in Ireland, and John Waters gives a fantastic speech on the issue of separated parents and the fact that it's a human rights issue.
A speaker is somebody who, as we say in the country, doesn't need any introduction at all, and then we go on and introduce him at length. But he is a journalist and a social commentator. He comes from that stable of journalism where they used to have an ad, I think, that if you didn't get the Irish Times, you missed part of the day. But then somebody quipped on one occasion that if you read the Irish Times, you'll miss the whole day. However, having said that, John Waters, journalist and social commentator.
Thank you very much. I thank Father One for returning us to reality, because often these matters we can get involved in discussions which seek to be responsible, which seek to normalise the extraordinary. And I think that's a great danger, that we begin to talk about a problem like we now face as though it were simply some kind of adjustment that needed to be required, that there was some kind of mysterious dimension to the organisation of our affairs which just needs to be found and tripped, and then we're fine. That's not what's happening here. Father One describes the truth. He told the truth. This is the truth. I'm sorry, but the minister doesn't seem to know what the truth is. I was at a launch 2 weeks ago of this report, which the minister mentioned, by Harry Ferguson and Fergus Hogan. And this report is the most devastating indictment of the statutory services of this state in relation to the treatment of fathers. If what is said in relation to the statutory services and the treatment of fathers in this state were reported in respect of any other subgroup in society, there would be uproar and outrage on a 24-hour basis until it was fixed. The minister stood up and he said, "Oh yes, I hear it. I hear it. I accept. I've read it. I will do something." And what does he do? He goes out and the first thing he does, he attacks the abused. The first thing he comes up with is child support. That the abused victims of the statutory services of this state must pay for their abuse they suffer in money terms. They must pay their abusers for their day's work. Well, no. We need to get real. This is either a human rights issue or it's not. If it's not, let's go home. And let's leave it to the statutory services to get on with their professional responsibilities. Is it or isn't it? Well, of course it is. This report, in a very understated way, I don't agree with everything in it, but in a very understated way, it describes a grotesque, institutionalized abuse of the rights of fathers and children. The only response by responsible, just and decent officialdom will be to take this report and walk into offices in the social services of this state the next morning and say, "Clean up your act. You are a disgrace to your profession and to the principles that you are paid to uphold." So, interestingly as well, there's a very good chapter in this about anger. And I once had an argument on the radio with Harry Ferguson about my anger. And he started off the debate by saying that men needed to get in touch with their feelings. And I gave him a blast of my feelings. And he said, "Oh no, you're too angry." So, apparently, you know, when we want men to be in touch with their feelings, we'd like to be selective about what feelings we will receive. But interestingly in this, there's a very good description and analysis of what happens in the process of anger and anger letting. Because these people who weren't disposed, I mean, they would regard me as a complete extremist, they aren't disposed to the notion of expressing anger about these matters. But what they said was that the interviews they conducted, generally speaking, were 2 to 2.5 hours long. And what they said, they take them all and subsequently they transcribe them all. And what they found was that the first 30 minutes or so of the interview was complete, undiluted rage. But then, and it was only when they transcribed this that actually appreciated, comprehended this, that actually the feelings moderated and they became softer. Grief, sadness, disbelief. And then the rationality, the analysis came out. What was actually happening? Because that's very important. Unfortunately, because we live in a media society, it's very difficult to get across. You don't get 2.5 hours to say your piece. If you're lucky, you get 2.5 minutes. So all you can communicate is the rage. And that rage, as I've said, is justified. If the injustices detailed in this report were perpetrated against Romanians, or Jews, or travellers, or women, or homosexuals, or any other subgroup, there would be nothing else talked about in this state for the past fortnight and for the next year. These are outrageous abuses of fundamental human rights. So why are we talking about, you know, how we adjust the system, how we tweak here, what do we need to listen to anymore? What facts do we need? What new facts, what new information is necessary? It's all here. We don't need to listen. There's a big lie at the heart of all this discussion. I keep saying it, but it's very important to repeat. There's a lie that this is all about disputes, animosity between people, between men and women, between husbands and wives, mothers, fathers. That's the lie. This is not about animosity. It's not that, you know, as they constantly try to depict themselves, the unfortunate state services and the unfortunate legal profession are here sort of, you know, and then caught in the middle of these intractable disputes, which they try to fix to the best of their ability. That's not what's happening. You know, what's happening here is not about, you know, some kind of a, you know, dispute about some grey area of entitlements, which are, you know, misunderstood or, you know, disputed legitimately between men and women. What's happening here is actually that men and women are being forced into a situation where they dispute not about the totality of their rights, not about even a small sort of middle section of their rights, but about the entirety of the father's rights. That, if you like to look at it, if you divide that screen into two, and on the left hand, crudely, you have the father's involvement. On the right, you have the mother's. Well, the dispute is actually happening over at that boundary. It's not happening in the middle. It's happening at the extremity, where mothers are allowed and supported by state services in excluding the father completely. The issue is not, you know, what mothers and fathers can agree among themselves about their mutual roles. It's about whether or not the father has any involvement whatsoever. And the state policy up to now has been to assist the mother to the maximum of its ability in trying to push the father over that edge. That's the reality. That's the issue. We either understand that or we don't. There's no point talking about intractable disputes. It's not about that. The next thing we need to consider here is that this isn't about me. I spent 10 years talking about this. Others have spent, they will go on 15 years speaking what the dogs in the street know. Right? I'm 10 years now doing it. I shouldn't have to be here saying this. This is not just about my rights. It's not just about my child's rights. It's not just about any subgroup of men discriminated against, abused, mistreated, vulnerable men, whatever you want to call it. This is about everybody, and it's not just about every man, it's about every person. Of course it's about every man, potentially every potential father. All fathers are vulnerable. Because, let me tell you, no matter how secure you think you are as a father today in this society, you are as a guest of the mother of your children. You exist in your house and in the company of your children as a guest. No more. And the moment that willingness to allow you to remain is suspended, you are dead. You have no rights. And this state will do nothing to vindicate you in any way whatsoever. It will seek in whatever way it can to abuse you and frighten you away and impoverish you and drive you into suicide if possible. That would be the idea, I think, sometimes. So we either serious about talking about the issue is, or we're here just to pretend that, you know, we have some minor grievance about, you know, the way things are organized. But I don't have any grievance. I want to turn the whole system upside down. I want to indict the people who run the system. I want to fire them all. I want to, you know, remove the corrupt social workers, the corrupt judges, the corrupt lawyers, the corrupt politicians. I want to point to them and say, would you be allowed to get away with this in relation to any other subgroup? Imagine if you had done this in relation to travellers, for example. Do you think you would get away? Do you think you would be allowed to stay in your job and not be deemed a racist? Of course you wouldn't. So here we are, you know, as we used to say, in the mouth of Christmas. And I thought, you know, we'd come here today and maybe have some kind of reasonable discussion, but it started off bad. I've never in my life heard so many weasel words in a speech as I heard in the minister's speech this morning. So many opt-outs, so many cop-outs, so many ifs and buts and maybes and if it's practical and if it's possible and if, you know, when. This is not about some mysterious problem that needs to kind of be assessed by committees and surveys and all the rest of it. It's very, very simple. We have a fundamental abuse of the rights of fathers and children in this society, which we need to fix tomorrow. Today, we have enough time. It's only 11:30 yet. We could do it by lunchtime. With a stroke of the minister's pen, he could issue an injunction to his officials in the department that they must mend their ways, that what they're doing is unacceptable. And that message would go out to the judges, to the lawyers in this society, that the game was up. Because remember, this is not, again, you know, in terms of the legal profession and the family courts. I've said this before and I'll say it again. Again, lawyers like to present themselves as, you know, caught helplessly in the middle of these intractable disputes. The bias of the family court system is not purely a matter of culture and ideology. It's also hugely a matter of vested interest. If the bias of the family courts did not exist, then mothers would have no interest, no motivation to consistently go to court and try to dispossess the fathers. Similarly, they would have no motivation to force fathers to the point where they had no choice but to get the crumbs off the table, they had to go to court. If the family court did not have that inbuilt bias. So, if you were setting up a system from which you wanted to make money, would you not, as a precaution, try to create an imbalance, a bias like that, so as to suck people in, so as to maximise your earnings, so as to strip your so-called clients of everything they have, in the guise of helping them, in the guise of, you know, justice? There is no justice. There was a very interesting case, as you'll be aware, in the UK at the moment with the Home Secretary. Now, little did we think 10 years ago when we were talking about these issues that one day, very soon, the Home Secretary of the United Kingdom would be implicated in these very issues. But here we are, in a state which has turned its face against fathers for 10 years, which has ignored a group like Families Need Fathers for 20 years, 22 years now, I think, which has, you know, come up again, as did the minister last week, with this nonsense about, you know, throwing in a few bob to the bringing up of their children. What an insult to the many fathers who have thrown in buckets of their blood to the bringing up of their children, and to fighting to get some kind of recognition in this corrupt society for that purpose. There was a judgment in the papers last week by Mr. Justice Ryder in the High Court in London, and it struck me, because it was public, uniquely and unprecedentedly for such judgments, reading the judgment, things struck me that anybody reading this judgment would have been wondering, what the hell has been going on about? This is an entirely rational and fair judgment. You know, it speaks the truth. It seems to kind of be seeking to be even-handed and balanced. It gives a little bit here and a little bit there. But let me tell you, if that judgment had not been in public, or if the father at the core of it had not been the Home Secretary of the United Kingdom, what it would have said is the following, something like this. The problem here is that the mother is upset. She doesn't like the father anymore, and she doesn't want him around. And because the mother is upset, the children are upset. And that's all terrible. So, in order to stop the children being upset, our solution is that the father goes away. Now, actually, that analysis is... And in fact, the next day I got a call from a man. If you think I'm making it up, I got a call from a man who told me precisely that in relation to a psychiatrist's evaluation of his assessment of his family. He'd been seeing his child for 6 years on a weekly basis, and he'd been saying, "Oh, it's going very well. We're happy with your fathering skills and all the rest of it. But unfortunately, the mother doesn't like it. So we're reducing your access." Now, if that logic had been inflicted in any other kind of case, people would be laughing in the street. They would be rolling around. They wouldn't be able to walk from the laughter of it. the obscenity of that logic. Because that logic, what it actually says, is that this mother is completely unfit to bring up children at all. Because she doesn't understand that the father's love for his children is a vital part of their nurturing. So those children should be taken away from her immediately. That's the logic. That's the uncorrupt logic. But instead, in a secret court in Ireland, in the case I mentioned, the man I mentioned will probably in the future, very soon, like Father A, lose all contact with these children. And will happen invisibly. And he will become 10 and invisible and more invisible. And people will wonder what's happened to him. And they will say he's bitter and angry and twisted. See, we can't help but be bitter and angry and twisted. What else would you be if you knew what was going on? If you knew what was going on and were not bitter and angry and twisted, you wouldn't be a human being at all. You wouldn't have any right to claim that you understood what justice was. Nor would you have any right to claim that you understood what makes this society function. That's the final point. This is, in fact, the point I came to make. The emotions that we express in this poisonous ideological climate are constantly depicted as the emotions of ego, rage, anger, shouting and roaring. They're not. Maybe some parts of them are, but we live in a civilization. We've grown up. I've lived nearly 50 years in a civilization. What angers me is not, I believe, some core sense of my own egotism. It is the metaphysical outrage of seeing the principles that I was reared with abused and betrayed and trampled on a daily basis, taking calls from men like Dr. A who make me weak on a daily basis. And those emotions we need to take very clear cognizance of. Not because of me, not because of my hurt, not because of my rage, not because of my sadness, nor indeed the sadness or rage of any individual man, but because those feelings are carriers of something urgent for this society. They are carriers of a profound message that if you trample and degrade and scrunch up the values which you have created over generations, there will be nothing there when you go looking for them. So, making love legal. Love is a very complex thing. I don't know, I mean, we could be here all day talking about what love is. All week. We could get into sentiment, we could get into loyalty, we could get into duty, we could get into responsibility. All I know is that when I was faced with the choice of fighting or walking away, I knew I had to fight. Not because I wanted to. Not because I wanted to lose my reputation and my livelihood and my house and my friends. But because there's something in me, which is in everyone, if we seek to find it. Our fathers and our mothers and our grandfathers and our grandmothers are behind us, prodding us in the back. Go, you bollocks. Because that's what we do. Right? Now, those forces in this society are hugely potent. And if we tamper with them, they will turn on us in a generation. And they will destroy those who have destroyed them. That is my promise. Thank you.
I'm a bit of a technical difficulty. I haven't really slept very much over the last couple of days. I've had my whole family in the country chasing me around various bars and, you know, places. And we did a harbour cruise the other day and it's been extremely full on. And, you know, just about ready to declare myself old and lie down and have a bit of a rest after it all.
In case you missed it, it was Ian's birthday today.
Today.
And it's mine tomorrow. Our birthdays are 24 hours apart. How's that?
We're practically twins, you and me, Rock and Pop.
I don't know whether that's a good thing or not.
No, well, I reckon it's a pretty good thing. I mean, it's probably not good for you to be like me, but it's certainly good for me to be like you, I think.
Oh, well, I always thought it would be the other way around. Right. You're a lot younger than me, Ian.
And I rest my case.
Just as well the
Should
listeners
we,
can't
in the
see
few
us.
Minutes we've got left, revert to a serious topic?
Oh, well, go on, John. Come on. Yeah, okay. Okay, serious topic.
There's new domestic violence laws in Australia.
Oh, shocking, yeah, shocking.
In New South Wales, in fact, in the state from which we broadcast, New South Wales has created a domestic violence offence. New South Wales government says the state's new domestic violence laws will put a, quote, permanent stain, unquote, on the records of offenders. The new laws passed by Parliament create a specific domestic violence offence. Attorney General John Hatzigos says the changes will make it easier for police to track repeat offenders, obtain interim apprehended violence orders and search for a greater range of weapons at the scene of domestic violence incidents. I think a saucepan can now be regarded as a weapon.
A weapon. Oh,
so if you live in a house with a saucepan, you can be charged with having weapons in the house.
Look, I mean, I just think it's ridiculous. I mean, we don't condone any kind of violence at all, but I mean, it's just going, it's becoming ridiculous, in my opinion. I mean, we've all been in relationships that haven't worked. That's why we're here, and we all understand the way things can be twisted. You know, and to empower the twisters or whatever, I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's going to clog the courts with more garbage than they need. It's going to fill the pockets of lawyers. It's regressive drivel, in my opinion.
I think what one of the main problems is that under the new changes, the presumption will be that children are included on the victim's apprehended violence order unless there's a good reason for them not to be. Now, previously that wasn't the case. Like if you were alleged to have been abusive and you had an order taken out against you, it would not stop you from seeing your children because the abuse was not against your children. But now they're automatically going to be presumed to be part of that violence.
I mean, to bring in just a personal little story here, I mean, I photocopied some information last week and I put it in the bag that my son took back to my estranged wife.
I don't know that we should talk about it.
I got threatened with an AVO for putting paper in a bag. I mean, violence. I didn't think it was particularly violent myself.
Well, all sorts of accusations fly around in all sorts of ways. The Attorney General said for the first time we'll automatically include children as part of the apprehended violence orders in a family situation. The government is committed to reducing the scourge of domestic violence and these reforms will help. It's absolutely unclear that any of this legislation has helped decrease the level of interpersonal violence in the community, and indeed every study you see says it's increasing, despite tens of millions of dollars of advertising campaigns and so on and so forth. There's no evidence that any of this actually works, is there?
And you heard Dean Tong, he said that 70% of those allegations turn out to be false.
I'm not sure what the level of false accusations and domestic violence is, but certainly, anecdotally anyway, it's extremely high.
And the bottom line, of course, is that the reason why people are becoming more violent and society is becoming more violent, I don't think there's any dispute about that, is basically fatherlessness. If more fathers were allowed to spend more time with their children, there would be a lot less violence in this world.
And what about the issue of these are state laws, but by these state laws they can actually sabotage federal laws. Family laws are federal, and they can take out an apprehended violence order under state laws, and you can be eliminated from your kids.
Well, I think the whole AVO industry is completely ridiculous. I mean, after my experience, you know, this very week. The whole thing's just completely ridiculous. I mean, violence is the use of excessive force. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that is being declared to be violence, I'm sorry, putting a printed piece of paper in someone's bag, I cannot be convinced that there is any violence in that sort of activity.
Yes, it's a very ever-broadening definition. One study showed that 7% of people now think that not speaking to your partner at breakfast time is domestic violence.
And we
that makes about 100% of the population guilty, I think.
Yeah, and we had the case of that, I forget his guy's name, but he got jailed for waving at his children. I mean, It just seems to me it's absolutely out of control. Look, we don't condone violence. You know,
not at
violence,
all.
None of us do. We're not. Nobody here is violent. I'm not a violent person, nor are you Rock and Pop.
Definitely not.
And nor are you, John. And I'm sure.
Oh,
you know,
thank you so much.
But well,
brain feels a bit crazy some days, but anyway.
No, you don't. I mean, but this is. It just seems to me like the whole issue is it's over the top. It's going too far. It's completely ridiculous. Society on this particular level, as with so many others, is losing the plot.
Well, certainly the plot has been lost for the Environment Minister Phil Koperberg, who's been stood down pending a police investigation. This is all on the weekend. There were front page stories from a 20-year-old
affidavit 20 years ago from
a 20-year-old affidavit from his ex. There was no police involvement, so there was no record of the incident, if there was an incident.
And all of this because she said, and this was, and apparently they reconciled after the alleged incident and got back together again for a while, even though subsequently they did divorce. I mean,
so an allegation can taint you for life, can lose you your job.
20 years down the track, a man who appears to be extremely competent, he was certainly competent as the bushfire guy when he was, running the
Rural Bushfire Service.
Exactly.
He
Thank
did
you,
a great
John.
Service there.
He did a fantastic job.
Much admired, and he's very pragmatic. He was a man who believed in getting things done, and he didn't have much time for politicians at the time.
And now his whole political career, his fledgling political career, because he's only been in politics for what, less than 12 months, has been completely derailed by an allegation from 20 years ago. I mean, this is ludicrous.
Lunacy.
And next week we have
Joep Zander from the Netherlands. He's an activist and a very active father's rights in the father's rights movement in Holland, and he'll be doing an interview with us. We'll be featuring that next week. Joep Zander.
We'll be back.
We're dads on the air, we're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't.